Chapter 45 Avasarala. As I see it, sir, Avasarala said, the die is already cast. We effectively have two courses of policy already in play. The question now is how we move forward. So far, I've been able to keep the information from getting out, but once it does, it will be devastating. And since it is all but certain that the artifact is able to communicate, the chances of an effective military usage of these proto-molecule human hybrids is essentially nil. If we use this weapon, we will be creating a second Venus, committing genocide, and removing any moral argument against using weapons like accelerated asteroids against the Earth itself. I hope you will excuse the language, sir, but this was a cock-up from the start. The damage done to human security is literally unimaginable. It seems clear at this point that the proto-molecule project underway on Venus is aware of events in the Jovian system. It's plausible that the samples out here have the information gained from the destruction of the Arbogast. To say that makes our position problematic is to radically understate the case. If it had gone through the appropriate channels, we would not be in this position. As it stands, I have done all that is presently within my capabilities given my situation. The coalition I have built between Mars, elements of the Belt, and the legitimate government of Earth are ready to take action. But the United Nations must distance itself from this plan and move immediately to isolate and defang the faction within the government that has been doing this weasel shit. Again, excuse the language. I have sent copies of the data included here to Admiral Souther and Lenicki, as well as to my team on the Venus problem. They are, of course, at your disposal to answer any questions if I am not available. I'm very sorry to put you in the position, sir, but you are going to have to choose sides in this, and quickly. Events out here have developed a momentum of their own. If you're going to be on the right side of history on this, you must move now. If there's any history to be on the right side of, she thought. She tried to come up with something else that she could say. Some other argument that would penetrate the layers of old-growth wood that surrounded the Secretary-General's brain. There weren't any, and repeating herself in simple storybook rhyme would probably come off as condescending. She stopped the recording, cut off the last few seconds of her looking into the camera in despair, and sent it off with every high-priority flag there was and diplomatic encryption. So this was what it came to. All of human civilization, everything it had managed, from the first cave painting to crawling up the gravity well and pressing out into the antechamber of the stars, came down to whether a man, whose greatest claim to fame was that he'd been thrown in prison for writing bad poetry, had the balls to back down Ehrenreich. The ship corrected under her, shifting like an elevator suddenly slipping its tracks. She tried to sit up, but the gimbaled couch moved. God, but she hated space travel. Is it going to work? The botanist stood in her doorway. He was stick-thin, with a slightly larger head than looked right. He wasn't built as awkwardly as a belter, but he couldn't be mistaken for someone who'd grown to maturity living at full gravity. Standing in her doorway, trying to find something to do with his hands, he looked awkward and lost and slightly otherworldly. I don't know, she said. If I were there, it would happen the way I want it to happen. I could go squeeze a few testicles until they saw it my way. From here, maybe, maybe not. You can talk to anyone from here, though, can't you? It isn't the same. He nodded, his attention shifting inward. Despite the differences in skin color and build, the man suddenly reminded her of Michael John. He had the same sense of being a half-step back from everything. Only Michael John's detachment verged on autism. And Praxitiki Mung was a little more visibly interested in the people around him. They got to Nicola, he said. They made her say those things about me, about May. Of course they did. That's what they do. And if they wanted to, they'd have papers and police reports to back it all up, backdated and put in the databases of everywhere you ever lived. I hate it that people think I did that. Avasarala nodded, then shrugged. Reputation never has very much to do with reality, she said. I could name half a dozen paragons of virtue that are horrible, small-souled, evil people. And some of the best men I know, you'd walk out of the room if you heard their names. No one on the screen is who they are when you breathe their air. Holden, Prax said. Well, he's the exception, she said. The botanist looked down and then up again. His expression was almost apologetic. May's probably dead, he said. You don't believe that. It's been a long time. Even if they had her medicine, they've probably turned her into one of these things. You still don't believe that, she said. The botanist leaned forward, frowning like she'd given him a problem he couldn't immediately solve. Tell me it's all right to bomb Io. I can have 30 nuclear warheads fired now. Turn off the engines, let them fly ballistic. They won't all get through, but some will. Say the word now, and I can have Io reduced to slag before we even get there. You're right, Prax said. And then a moment later, why aren't you doing that? Do you want the real reason or my justification? Both? I justify it this way, she said. I don't know what is in that lab. I can't assume that the monsters are only there, and if I destroy the place, I might be slagging the records that would let me find the missing ones. I don't know everyone involved in this, and I don't have proof against some of the ones I do know. It may be down there. I'll go, I'll find out, and then I will reduce the lab to radioactive glass afterward. Those are good reasons. They're good justifications. I find them very convincing. But the reason is that May might still be alive. I don't kill children, she said. Not even when it's the right thing to do. You would be surprised how often it's hurt my political career. People used to think I was weak until I found the trick. The trick. If you can make them blush, they think you're a hard-ass, she said. My husband calls it the mask. Oh, Prax said. Thank you. Waiting was worse than the fear of battle. Her body wanted to move, to get away from her chair and walk through the familiar halls. The back of her mind shouted for action, movement, confrontation. She paced the ship top to bottom and back again. Her mind went through trivia about all the people she met in the halls, the small detritus from the intelligence reports she'd read. The mechanic, Amos Burton, implicated in several murders, indicted, never tried. Took an elective vasectomy the day he was legally old enough to do so. Naomi Nagata, the engineer. 2 master's degrees. Offered full-ride scholarship for a PhD on Ceres Station and turned it down. Alex Kamal, pilot. 7 drunk and disorderlies when he was in his early 20s. Had a son on Mars he still didn't know about. James Holden, the man without secrets. The holy fool who dragged the solar system into war and seemed utterly blind to the damage he caused. An idealist. The most dangerous kind of man there was. And a good man, too. She wondered whether any of it mattered. The only real player near enough to talk to, without lag turning the conversation utterly epistolary, was Souther, and he was still putatively on the same side as Nguyen, and preparing to face battle with the ships protecting her. The opportunities were few and far between. Have you heard anything? He asked from her terminal. No, she said. I don't know what's taking the fucking bobblehead so long. You're asking him to turn his back on the man he's trusted the most. And how fucking long does that take? When I did it, it was over in maybe 5 minutes. Sorin, I said, you're a douchebag. Get out of my sight. It isn't harder than that.
And if he doesn't come through?
Souther asked.
She sighed.
Then I call you back and try talking you into going rogue.
Ah, Souther said with a half-smile.
And how do you see that going?
I don't like my chances, but you never know. I can be damn persuasive.
An alert popped up. A new message. From Arjun.
I have to go, she said.
Keep an ear to the ground, or whatever the hell you do out here where the ground doesn't mean anything.
Be safe, Christian, Souther said, and vanished into the green background of a dead connection.
Around her, the galley was empty. Still, someone might come in. She lifted the hem of her sari and walked to her little room, sliding her door closed before she gave her terminal permission to open the file. Arjun was at his desk, his formal clothes on, but undone at the neck and sleeves. He looked like a man just returned from a bad party. The sunlight streamed in behind him. Afternoon, then. It had been afternoon when he'd sent it. And it might still be. She touched the screen, her fingertips tracing the line of his shoulder.
So, I understand from your message that you may not come home, he said.
I'm sorry, she said to the screen.
As you imagined, I find the thought distressing, he said.
And then a smile split his face, dancing in eyes she now saw were red with tears.
But what can I do about it? I teach poetry to graduate students. I have no power in this world. That has always been you. And so I want to offer you this. Don't think about me. Don't take your mind from what you're doing on my account. And if you don't...
Arjun took a deep breath.
If life transcends death, then I will seek for you there. If not, then there too.
He looked down and then up again.
I love you, Kiki. And I will always love you, from whatever distance.
The message ended. Avasarala closed her eyes. Around her, the ship was as close and confining as a coffin. The small noises of it pressed in against her until she wanted to scream, until she wanted to sleep. She let herself weep for a moment. There was nothing else to be done. She had taken her best shot, and there was nothing to be done but meditate and worry. Half an hour later, her terminal chimed again, waking her from troubled dreams. Ehrenreich. Anxiety knotted her throat. She lifted a finger to begin the playback and then paused. She didn't want to. She didn't want to go back into that world, wear her heavy mask. She wanted to watch Arjun again, listen to his voice. Only, of course, Arjun had known what she would want. It was why he'd said the things he had. She started the message. Ehrenreich looked angry. More than that, he looked tired. His pleasant demeanor was gone, and he was a man made entirely of salt water and threat.
Christian, he said. I know you won't understand this, but I have been doing everything in my power to keep you and yours safe. You don't understand what you've waded into, and you are fucking things up. I wish you had had the moral courage to come to me with this before you ran off like a horny 16-year-old with James Holden. Honestly, if there was a better way to destroy any professional credibility you once had, I can't think what it would have been. I put you on the Guan Shi Yin to take you off the board because I knew that things were about to go hot. Well, they are. Only you're in the middle of them, and you don't understand the situation. Millions of people stand in real danger of dying badly because of your egotism. You're one of them. Arjun's another, and your daughter. All of them are in threat now because of you.
In the image, Ehrenreich clasped his hands together, pressing his knuckles against his lower lip, the platonic ideal of a scolding father. If you come back now, I might be able to save you. Not your career, that's gone, forget it. Everyone down here sees that you're working with the OPA and Mars. Everyone thinks you've betrayed us, and I can't undo that. Your life and your family, that's all I can salvage. But you have to get away from this circus you've started, and you have to do it now. Time's short, Christian. Everything important to you hangs in the balance, and I cannot help you if you don't help yourself. Not with this. It's last chance time. Ignore me now, and the next time we talk, someone will have died. The message ended. She started it again, and then a third time. Her grin felt feral. She found Bobby in the ops deck with the pilot Alex. They stopped talking as she came in, a question in Bobby's expression. Avasarala held up a finger and switched the video feed to display on the ship monitors. Ehrenreich came to life. On the big screen, she could see his pores and the individual hairs in his eyebrows. As he spoke, Avasarala saw Alex and Bobby grow sober, leaning in toward the screen as if they were all at a poker table and coming to the end of a high-stakes hand. All right, Bobby said. What do we do?
We break out the fucking champagne, Avasarala said. What did he just tell us? There is nothing in that message. Nothing. He is walking around his words like they've got poison spikes on them, and what's he got? Threats. No one makes threats.
Wait, Alex said. That was a good sign.
That was excellent, Avasarala said.
And then something else, something small, fell into place in the back of her mind, and she started laughing and cursing at the same time.
What? What is it?
If life transcends death, then I will seek for you there. If not, then there too, she said. It's a fucking haiku. That man has a one-track mind and one train on it. Poetry. Save me from poetry.
They didn't understand, but they didn't need to. The real message came 5 hours later. It came on a public news feed, and it was delivered by Secretary General Esteban Sorrento Gillis. The old man was brilliant at looking somber and energetic at the same time. If he hadn't been the executive of the largest governing body in the history of the human race, he'd have made a killing promoting health drinks. The whole crew had gathered by now. Amos, Naomi, Holden, Alex, even Prax. They were sandwiched into the ops deck, their combined breaths just slightly overloading the recyclers and giving the deck a feeling of barn heat. All eyes were on the screen as the Secretary General took the podium.
I have come here tonight to announce the immediate formation of an investigative committee. Accusations have been made that some individuals within the governing body of the United Nations and its military forces have taken unauthorized and possibly illegal steps in dealing with certain private contractors. If these accusations are true, they must be addressed in the most expedient possible manner. If unfounded, they must be dispelled, and those responsible for spreading these lies called to account. I need not remind you all of the years I spent as a political prisoner.
Oh, fuck me, Avasarala said, clapping her hands in glee. He's using the outsider speech. That man's asshole must be tight enough right now to bend space.
I have dedicated my terms as Secretary General to rooting out corruption, and as long as I have this gavel, I shall continue to do so. Our world and the solar system we all share must be assured that the United Nations honors the ethical, moral, and spiritual values that hold us all together as a species.
On the feed, Esteban Sorrento Gillis nodded, turned, and strode away in a clamor of unacknowledged questions, and the commentators flowed into the space, talking over each other in all the political opinions of the spectrum.
Okay, Holden said. So, did he actually say anything?
He said Ehrenreich is finished, Avasarala said.
If he had any influence left at all, that announcement would never have been made. God damn, I wish I was there. Ehrenreich was off the board. All that left was Nguyen, Mao, Strickland, or whoever he was, their half-controlled proto-molecule warriors, and the building threat of Venus. She let a long breath rattle through her throat and the spaces behind her nose. "Ladies and gentlemen," she said, "I have just solved our smallest problem."